This is all theater. It's all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political
theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill across the country. I'm Jason Dick. Mark McKinnon is a man who knows his way around campaigns and politics. In a previous life, he was an advisor to folks like Congressman Lloyd Doggett, Texas Governor Ann Richards, Governor, then President George W. Bush, and the iconic senator from my home state, John McCain of Arizona. Now a co-host for the Showtime political documentary series, The Circus, he joins us today to talk about President Joe Biden's first 100 days, Biden's speech to a joint address of Congress on Wednesday evening, and the current political climate. Mark, it's nice to welcome a fellow man of the West to political theater.
Thanks for putting me on the dance card.
So the speech, I mean, this was one of those things like, you know, I don't know how many of these you've tuned into, been there for, you know, helped, you know, advise on, attended. This was one that we'll remember for a while. Not so much the content, because it eventually became kind of a standard address to Congress by a president, but the first two women on the dais behind him, of Vice President, of Speaker, Kamala Harris and Nancy Pelosi, just how spread out it was, how few people were there because of COVID. What was just you know, on a personal level, you've seen a lot of these speeches. What was going through your mind as you're watching this speech?
Well, thanks for having me on. A lot went through my mind. This was historic in a lot of ways, but one of the things that went through my mind is, yeah, you're right. I've seen a lot of these, but Joe Biden has seen 48 of them in person, right? So this is his like 48th time to be in that chamber for that speech, except this time he was the one delivering the speech. And the thing that strikes me most about the speech, the first 100 days of Biden presidency altogether, is just how different this all is and was compared to what we might have thought 6 months ago about Joe Biden. I think we all thought, and I think he thought, that if he were elected, he was going to be a transitional president. And I think he even said that at one point in the campaign, sort of an incremental guy that would do incremental things, given kind of the nature of the country and the polarization. And what's happened is that he has gone from being transitional to transformational, at least in ambition. And that's what we saw in the speech, was that, you know, been a lot of comparisons to FDR. But Biden has kind of throughout his career, I think one of the things that maybe part of his experience of being there 48 times is he kind of like deals with the art of the possible. And he was a man for the moment in the campaign and kind of rose to the moment in that 48 hours in South Carolina. And that's sort of what's happening with his presidency, too. I think he's just adapted to the moment. And so, you know, and we know from reporting that he's been having sort of meetings with historians, and he's really trying to figure out what, given the circumstances that we've inherited, what is possible. And the thing that really was completely striking to everybody last night was just how big he went. You know, I don't think he could go any bigger, right? I mean, in terms of sort of the canvas that he laid out last night. And that's, of course, what Republicans are going to jump on, just to say this is, you know, completely a Pandora's tax and spend box. And this is just nutty. But, you know, I think Biden just laid it all out. And, you know, with the expectation, of course, that not all or maybe even much of it will get done, but some of it will, and some of it may be enough.
Yeah, and you know, he was able to get through, you know, this $1.9 trillion package early. You know, again, we're at day. This is day 100, right? So, you know, that was a, you know, sort of a big accomplishment. You know, including, you know, $1,400 checks to the neediest people. You know, very tangible things. Extending, you know, the Affordable Care Act signups. You know. So that people who had lost their jobs or lost their health insurance could sign up more easily. So he has like these tangible wins, and then he's like, "All right, now we're going to keep going." as you said, that is less transition, and it is more transformational. But it's just not, I mean, even in a closely divided, you know, Senate and House, where they can pass things through the reconciliation budget process, which enables them to basically, you know, not worry about a filibuster. It's not that easy. I mean, there are a lot of shots at Joe Manchin taking notes. what would you make of that?
Yeah, exactly. Somebody was saying that there should have been a camera dedicated to Joe Manchin for the whole speech.
The Manch Cam.
The Manch Cam, right, exactly. Well, I mean, that's the reality of this, right? I mean, first of all, think about this. The most pressing crisis that's faced the country, arguably in decades, is the pandemic, right? And the relief package to address the greatest crisis has ever confronted this country got zero Republican votes. So, if that was the crisis of decades and couldn't get a single Republican vote, it's hard to imagine going forward south. Some of these other things are likely to get any either. I mean, Biden tried to kind of present this as being, you know, equivalent to the 1930s. It's really not. I mean, you know, when FDR came in with what he did, they were kind of at the bottom of the trough. We're really coming out of this thing right now, and employment's, you know, boosting, and the economy's roaring, and you know, so now these are all sort of like additional things to hang on the tree. So the point is that, to your point, it's hard to see how Biden gets really much, if any, support for any of these ideas going forward, and so then it gets into, you know, very arcane stuff about reconciliation and what can be reconciled, and, you know, if you can't get any Republican votes. And then ultimately, what I think down the line happens is, I mean, listen, again, I'm just kind of putting on my old, you know, campaign hat and reality check here, which is 2022 is right around the corner. In terms of practical realpolitik, which means that if I'm one of Biden's advisors, I'm sitting down with him and saying, look, I don't care how well things go in the next year and a half. There's probably going to be a Republican Congress a year and a half from now, for all the obvious reasons, historical reapportionment, all of that. So whatever we're going to do, we got to get done in the next year and a half. And I think this is going to, they will, you know, again, get caught trying to work with Republicans. They'll exhaust that and it won't work. And then they'll do through reconciliation whatever they can. And I think the practical reality of what is possible there is there'll probably be a skinnied down infrastructure bill that might be mostly, you know, bricks and mortar. You know, just sort of like a $1 trillion package that enough Republicans can get on board that maybe they can get 8 or 9 to get on board for a skinnied down infrastructure bill by itself, but that'll be it, even if they can even get that. And then I think what happens is, again, quite soon, they've got all these other ambitions, you know, the voting rights bill, all this other stuff. And then they say, well, you know, either it's not going to happen or we kill the filibuster. And that'll get pretty interesting, I think. And obviously there's a lot of resistance to that, including and especially Manchin and Sinema from your old home state. So, but, you know, once faced with that prospect of saying we either get nothing else done for the rest of our presidency or we kill the filibuster. And at that point, again, kind of getting political again, I haven't done a campaign in my entire life where people were like, give me the filibuster. People don't know what the hell the filibuster is. It's, you know, it's this arcane inside the beltway Washington process thing that nobody even understands, much less cares about. So if I were advising at that point, I'd say, screw it, kill it.
If they even have the votes for it too, you know, because yeah, there is the thing. I wonder, like, again, history would suggest that the Republicans are probably going to be in for, you know, a better midterm election than the Democrats, just the way things typically go, and also with different shifts in the country and where they're going. I mean, we don't know what the lines are going to look like, but it's, I wonder, is from a campaign advisor's perspective, is it enough for Republicans to just say no for the next year and a half to everything that Biden has? I mean, like, the image that sticks in my mind last night was of Mitch McConnell just you know, kind of sitting there dour with his surgical mask. Like, is that, if that's, and then Ted Cruz falling asleep, you know, if that's the Republican line, and then you have Tim Scott kind of saying, no, we're not racist. I mean, is that enough for Republicans to run on?
Good question. And I think you're right. I mean, everything we've heard so far has nothing to do with the future vision of the Republican Party. And as a Republican trying desperately to be a Republican still, it drives me crazy that it's so backward looking, and there, you know, that there needs to be something, you know, a blueprint that gives people an idea of what Republicans stand for. It may be enough for 2022. It's not, I don't think it's enough for 2024. And unless Republicans really kind of reinvent themselves, I'm not sure I'll see another Republican president in my lifetime. Because it's just gotten into a demographic cul-de-sac, which is problematic. Now, I do think that, you know, for 2022, it may be enough. I mean, particularly because the ambitions are so big that I think it, you know, it could sort of give enough people enough sort of pause to say, now, hold on a second. You know, I know we had to do some pandemic relief, but listen, jobs are doing just fine and the economy's coming back, and let's not screw this up. And I think that's kind of going to be what the Republicans are going to say. It'll be just to say, whoa, folks, you know, Biden's just, you know, they're going crazy here. Things are in relatively good shape. Let's not screw this up by going, you know, off the cliff. Like I say, that may be enough for 2022.
I mean, you mentioned that, you know, that if you had to, you know, maybe bet, you'd think that a slimmed down infrastructure package will pass in the next, you know, like, you know, several months or so. Shelley Moore Capito, one of the Republican senators who's been from West Virginia, she's been pushing, you know, an alternative infrastructure package that, you know, that we'll probably get some detail on fairly soon. I mean, it's about a quarter the size of what Biden and the Democrats are talking about. I'm curious what your read is. Like, it seems like Biden is almost reacting to the way things went in the first few years of the Obama administration when he was vice president, when they spent all this time courting, you know, Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, Chuck Grassley, you know, Orrin Hatch to try to get on board the ACA or the Affordable Care Act and you know, different stimulus packages. And it just ended up, like, they ended up with nothing. and then Obama didn't go on the road and say, like, hey, look what we got. It seems like, one, they're just like, okay, we'll listen to Republicans, but we're going to do our own thing. And then Biden isn't even waiting to tout things. He's on the road today in Georgia. You know, he's going to do a rally today with, you know, in outside of Atlanta. And then he's going to go visit Jimmy Carter tomorrow. You know, he's going to be at an Amtrak thing. I mean, he's just like, he's on the road show already.
Well, there's no question that that Biden has learned a lot of lessons from the administration he was a part of. And as take those lessons to heart. And it's quite clear that Biden is, again, going to try and get caught trying, but he's not going to wait and he's not going to lose the opportunity. And so he knows, again, this is 48 years of experience of being there. And so he knows and he's learned. And, you know, the real irony of all of this, of course, is that Obama was supposed to be the transformational president. And it's just they're flipping roles here, right? I mean, Obama really became kind of incremental because of those sort of mistakes that he made, which has allowed Biden to be the transformational one, having learned from those mistakes.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I was struck by, Biden, I think, won in large part, you know, because he kind of kept his head down and was calm, and he let Trump define himself, you know, which he had already done, but Trump became more Trumpy over the course of the campaign, and Biden was just like, "Hey, I'm just working on my white papers here," you know. and I wonder, like, you know, you still got a lot of friends in Congress and in politics and so forth, DR side, whatever. Do you think that there's just this sigh of relief that even if they would rather have a Republican president? I mean, we saw this the moment with Liz Cheney where they, you know, we were talking, you know, when Biden came into the chamber, and then on his way out, this Republican congressman, I think Troy Nels is his name. You know, he said, "I want to help you with you know, the police reform stuff," and Biden's like, "Well, I don't want to hurt your reputation." Like, do you think there's just this weird sigh of relief, like, "Oh wow, we can talk to this guy"?
There's no question about it. And I hear from my friends who are my Republican friends who are in Congress that, there is, they can't say it out loud, but there is a palpable sense of relief among all members that it's just that the temperature's just gone way down. And they know that they can talk to Biden, that he's a reasonable guy, that, you know, despite the kind of breadth of these proposals, that at the end of the day, he's, you know, he's a negotiator and he'll listen. And, you know, even though they had the power with Trump, it just, he drove them crazy too. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just to have a little bit of predictability and kind of, you know, to be able to get up in the morning and not have to read 10 tweets that were, you know, put out at 4 a.m. That were completely off script. It's just this, is like there's just some predictability in the market, you know, that in the political market now that's been absent that I think everybody appreciates.
And I mean, I'll note too, I mean, I saw the speech as prepared for delivery and then listened to it, and he went off script. I mean, Biden went off script almost as much as Trump has in some of his speeches. You know, even down to the last line, thank you for your patience. I mean, like there's almost like a Jeb, you know, please clap kind of moment there. But Biden seems to get away with it. Like, I realize that's kind of the brand, right? That like he's a grandfather-like figure. The country is so young and changing that you would think that wouldn't work, but it seems to be working at least at this point, 100 days in. You know, when you get 200 million vaccines in arms, you can almost do, you've got a little bit of leeway, right?
Yeah. And that was a very smart thing to, you know, create a very achievable target. Trump actually ought to get a little bit of credit for that, which I would love to have seen Biden do. It would have been very magnanimous, but not surprised that he didn't.
The 200 million shots is like, because I just came back from Phoenix. It was my first trip since the pandemic. I was visiting family, and I feel like it's American Airlines saying, oh yeah, on the trip from Phoenix to DC, it's going to take 4.5 hours. I'm like, it always takes 3 hours and 15 minutes. You're just saying that so you can build in like time. Yes. and make it look like you're really early when you're basically, you know, it takes about 3.5 hours.
Yeah. And that's smart politics. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. And, but again, I think that Biden is just, you know, it's working because he's coming in as kind of the healer in chief and just saying, okay, I'm going to put a thermometer in your mouth and we're going to take your temperature and we're going to lower the heat and we're going to bring the fever down. And, you know, part of the problem for Republicans is Biden is just a hard guy to hate. You know, he's just not that scary, which of course is why he won the Democratic nomination. And I tell my Democratic friends they should be praying every day that Biden got the nomination, because I don't think anybody else would have won it. And he's the only one who could be where we are today, I think, given his experience and his tone and approach, which is just, I think, again, sort of appreciated across the aisle.
And, you know, as somebody who is now covering this too, as part of the circus, Trump never left you for want of material. Are you worried about a little bit of a drop off in terms of the heat,
well,
heat and light?
100%. Yes, it's a surprise to me, but I sort of feel like the difference is that people have gone from watching our show because it was kind of like a Stephen King horror novel, and now it's like a Hallmark movie. You know?
With the occasional violent insurrection to kick things off, right? Like,
oh man, you know, that's just funny. You mentioned the insurrection. One of the just crazy things of the circus has been our just luck of timing. I pitched the show for 13 years, and they greenlighted it, you know, for that election that turned out to be the most surprising cliffhanging election of all time, with an asterisk to 2000. But when we were asked to come back for the Biden presidency, I was like, well, let's start with the inaugural. And they were like, no, let's come back a couple weeks early. And I said, that's going to be way too early. Nobody's going to be interested. And then, of course, that was the week that the insurrection happened, and it turns out to be the best episode we've ever produced.
Before I let you go, just curious, like in the next in the next month, you know, like you talked about how like the really 2022 is already with us, right? And we got the census numbers, like there's a scramble already. People don't know whether they're running or, you know, or not, you know, depending on how the lines are drawn. Politics never sleeps, I like to say. But we also have this legislative agenda. If you had to just pick one story that you were going to sort of follow in the next month or so, what would it be?
Well, not only does politics never sleep, I think politics is like, you know, snorted a bag of methamphetamine and is like never sleeps. I'm really interested in kind of all the voting legislation that's been happening in different states and kind of what's happening in also in Arizona right mm-hmm. now on this crazy audit.
Oh, man.
there's just, I think there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation about what's happening. And it's just something I take a lot of interest in. I'm in Colorado, where I think it's like the model for voting. I happen to be a Republican who believes that people should be able to vote as easily as possible. And in Colorado, every voter gets sent a ballot whether they want it or not. And 98% of people in Colorado vote by mail. It is completely secure. There are FBI trained analysts that check literally every single vote. When they told me that, I thought, oh, come on, it's got to be a random sampling. They check every single vote to verify it. And the Heritage Foundation, which, as you know, is a very conservative operation, did a study of all the mail-in balloting in Colorado to try and find any fraud. They looked at 17 million votes. They found 9 examples of a fraudulent address or something like that, which was probably accidental, at least half of those. So 9 out of 17 million. So I look, you know, it drives me nuts that the Republicans say, well, you know, this is just about the integrity of the process. Well, that's a solution in search of a problem. There really isn't a problem with integrity. They tried desperately to find integrity problems in the last election, and they couldn't find them, literally like zero. Trump's lawyer, you know, was asked to say, just show us one, and wasn't able to do that. Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, offered $1 million reward for examples of voter fraud. He has yet to reward a penny. So this thing's going to flesh itself out. But I hope that, it's not going to happen next year. But I just encourage all these secretaries of states and everywhere, look at Colorado. We're doing it right. It works.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for talking to Political Theater. It's great to have not just a guy who knows politics so well, but again, you know, a Westerner. So thank you so much. and we'd love to have you back sometime.
Thank you, brother. Kick it hard. Carry on regardless.